Republicans to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thanks for downloading the very latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. I've got a big one for you today. The most popular guest ever to be interviewed on the Peter B. Collins Show, whether podcast or radio broadcast, returns today. His name is John Perkins, and his latest book is The New Confessions of an Economic Hitman. Yeah, he took the money and ran. And he's been telling the story for years now, and it's opened up quite a few other issues for your evaluation. John Perkins talks honestly about the way international governments work. We talk about Greece, we talk about Puerto Rico, we talk about Detroit and Flint, and how the economic hitman methods have been brought home to the United States. And John Perkins also has a very positive message to share with you about empowerment via consumer confrontation with corporations. I think you'll find it very interesting. Let me thank the people who support my work with your subscriptions to the Peter B. Collins podcast, like Abby McMillan, Natalie Reel, Deborah Madera, and Joe Clarici. I truly appreciate your support. I invite others to join you, and to sweeten it, if you take out a new annual subscription right now and give me a mailing address in the continental U.S., I have an autographed copy of The New Confessions of an Economic Hitman by John Perkins as your bonus gift. I hope you'll sign up soon. Small, small world. John Perkins has made a name for himself as an author of a series of books about his previous career as an economic hitman. And I've talked with him many times before by telephone, but for the first time, he graces the secret studio today to talk about his latest book called The New Confessions of an Economic Hitman. John Perkins, great to see you.
Wonderful to be here with you, Peter. Thank you.
And I want to share this with my listeners. I told you before we started recording that I spoke to you several times after you published your first book. I think that was 2004. And we recorded those interviews. And as archived radio shows morphed into podcasting, your interviews on my syndicated radio show were the single most downloaded interviews that I did. And listeners were always eager for more, saying, when are you going to get Perkins back? And so I'm really happy to see you and delighted to share that with you, because I think you know that your book certainly struck a chord. But you may not know the dimensions of it, at least, you know, in this particular dimension, if you will.
Yeah, well, it's always great to hear that. I'm just such a charismatic guy, you know? Everybody loves me. I think in the last 12 years since that book came out, I've been pretty much on a world globe trotting tour, speaking in former Soviet countries, China, Middle East, Europe, Latin America, all over the United States and
Canada. But with what you have revealed, John, how have you avoided the polonium cocktail?
I think I got it. I talk in the New Confessions of an Economic Hitman. There's a chapter in there devoted to the time that I believe I was poisoned. I spent 2 weeks in a New York hospital. I was supposed to be speaking at the United Nations on a Tuesday morning. And a freelance journalist who I've been trying to stay away from, but it's a long story. It's in the book. But I ended up having lunch with him, and a couple hours later, I had lost 70% of my blood internally. Spent the next 2 weeks in a New York City hospital and had 70% of my colon removed.
Wow.
So, and there's a pretty strong theory that there was probably ground glass or something that in that lunch. I'd never been able to prove that. There was no way to prove it. In fact, didn't even think about that till after the operation was over. Just thought about surviving. And afterwards, when I talked to my doctor, he said, well, you know, he had no proof, but that certainly could have been the case.
Wow. Any other threats to your life or well-being over the disclosures that you've made?
You know, I always thought, Peter, that the book was my greatest insurance policy. And that, you know, anybody who didn't want the message to get out, the last thing they'd want to do is kill me. But, of course, if you die of something that looks like you had polyps and intestinal bleeding that came from natural causes, well, that's a different case. So that theory that I thought I was protected sort of fell between the cracks. I didn't talk about that incident in New York for quite a long time because I think I didn't really want to admit to it. Plus, I didn't want to give it energy. But Bechtel Corporation sent a nasty letter basically threatening to sue me unless we retracted statements we'd made about Bechtel and their connection to Panama. The Summer Institute of Linguistics did something similar. I had very good backup files. And my publisher sent copies of the backup files that showed that I had evidence for what I said to both of those organizations. And they backed off. They went away. The U.S. State Department issued a misinformation website specifically. I was the only person on it, the only book for many years. I don't know whether that's still true. I actually should look that up. I don't know whether that's still true or not. And they basically claimed that, I said that I was recruited by the National Security Agency, and their claim was that National Security only does encoding and decoding messages, which, of course, we all know is totally ridiculous. And people knew it back then, but people certainly know it now after Edward Snowden's revelations. So it sold a lot of books for me, but I think the State Department thought they had to issue a statement that their diplomats around the world could refer to when people asked, what's the official position on this book?
Now, you mentioned Ed Snowden. I was going to get to him a little bit later. But, I have always had a high regard for the principled stand that he took to disclose massive amounts of information. It confirmed a lot of what other NSA whistleblowers have been telling me. But Ed Snowden is a real failure in terms of the getaway plan. And I'm just curious what your review is of his spycraft.
Well, he's a very young man and probably somewhat naive. At least he was in Hong Kong when he made the revelations. He went to Russia. And as far as we know, he's living a decent life in Russia. Don't really know. I think he could have done things differently. On the other hand, unlike me, he was actually a CIA employee, and he'd signed documents. I never did that.
You didn't have a security clearance.
No, I didn't, and I'd never had to sign any confidentiality agreements. Well, I did sign some for Charles D. Maine, but they're not pertinent to this particular story. And so Snowden was in a very different position than the one that I'm in. You know, I think it's really tough to have actually been a government employee, especially at an agency like the NSA or the CIA or the FBI or any of those, and make these disclosures without tremendous risk to your life, or at the very least liability and prison. And Snowden's going through that now.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure there's any way he could have protected against that. Other than doing what he's been doing, it's a tough situation, and it's really unfortunate that, in what we claim to be a democracy, with freedom of speech that people don't have the right to make those kinds of disclosures.
But, John, the Obama administration is the most transparent in American history. They've told us that themselves.
Yes, they have. They've told us a lot of things, you know. And I think, Peter, you know, that the Obama administration has been a clear indication of how little power the president actually have. I happen to believe that Obama's probably a man of integrity, probably wanted, maybe intended to do most of the things that he campaigned and promised to do. But once he got in the Oval Office, he realized he just couldn't do them. He was read the Riot Act. There's many ways to assassinate a president these days. In Kennedy's day, everybody knew JFK was having affairs with lots of women. That didn't bring him down, and it took a bullet. By the time Clinton was president, he could be brought down, impeached, politically assassinated by a sex scandal. And so today, you know, Obama's got to know, and all major leaders have to know, that if they got any skeletons in their closet, and God knows who doesn't, the FBI knows, has seen those skeletons. And even if a person didn't have skeletons, the FBI could create them with its access to the internet today. Mm-hmm. So our leaders today are extremely vulnerable, because we all know that a sex scandal or a drug scandal will destroy a politician, or for that matter, CEOs of most corporations.
Well, it's interesting. I referred to other NSA whistleblowers, and one of them, Russell Tice, who was a high-ranking analyst, he told us, but he waited until after Snowden had given him a little bit of, I would say, political or legal cover. And at that point, Tice disclosed that in 2004, he saw the written wiretap orders to wiretap the phones of members of the Senate Intelligence Committee, including California's Dianne Feinstein. He saw wiretap orders specific to Senator Barack Obama. He saw wiretap orders for appointees to the Supreme Court, at that point Roberts and Alito. And he has told me that he believes that most top government electeds are under surveillance, and they know it. Mm-hmm. And we haven't yet cracked through the bubble, but we know what J. Edgar Hoover did with paper files.
Mm-hmm.
And he collected dirt on everybody in Washington, and he'd call you into his office and say, wouldn't it be a shame if your mistress became public?
Mm-hmm.
We would really hate for that to come out. You know, that'd just be a real sad thing, wouldn't it, Congressman? And so today, it's done, presumably, you know, on a much more elaborate scale and with amazing coverage. They have all of these resources, and they use them.
Right, right. And so the message there, Peter, is for us to know that it's we the people who have to make the change. You know, this presidential election circus that we're experiencing, is that a circus?
Mm-hmm.
You know, symbolically it matters who we elect to a certain degree, And certainly the world will look at us very differently if we elect a Trump as opposed to a Sanders.
Mm-hmm.
But the actual facts of the matter are that the president just doesn't have very much power. We used to think one of the powers the president had was to appoint a Supreme Court justice, and that's in question now. So,
yeah.
But I think this is really important for the American mm-hmm. people to understand that in a democracy, we have to do it. And the big corporations control Congress, they control the president, they control politics in this country today. And we need to understand that, but we control the big corporations because they depend on us to buy their goods and services, to invest in them, to work for them, and to support them through our tax dollars and government policies. The marketplace is a democracy if we will only use it as such.
John Perkins is my guest. His new book is The New Confessions of an Economic Hitman. And if you are new to this topic and you've never heard of John Perkins before, I'm going to save him a little work here because I have an excerpt from an interview I did with him back in 2007 where he very concisely answers my questions about jackals and economic hitmen. Let's start off with some key definitions here for people who didn't read the new book and are hearing about John Perkins for the first time. What is an EHM, an economic hitman?
Well, I think, Peter, is this better?
Yeah, that's better.
Okay.
Thank you.
I think it's fair to say that we economic hitmen have managed to create the world's first truly global empire during the last few decades. And we've done this primarily without the military, through economics. Therefore, it's been done largely in secret. Most people living in the United States have no idea that they're benefiting from the fruits of this worldwide empire. We operate in many different ways, but perhaps the most common is to identify a third world country that has resources our corporations covet, like oil.
Mm-hmm.
And then we arrange a huge loan to that country from the World Bank or one of its sisters. But the money doesn't actually go to the country. Instead, it goes to our own corporations that build big infrastructure projects in that country, power plants, industrial parks, ports, that sort of thing, things that benefit a few very rich people in the country, as well as our corporations, but don't benefit most of the people who are too poor to use much electricity, don't have the skills to get jobs in industrial parks, etc. And so at some point, we economic hitmen go back to the country and say, listen, you know, you've got a huge loan out. You can't repay your debt. So give us a pound of flesh. Sell your oil real cheap to our oil companies, or vote with us on the next critical United Nations vote, or send troops in support of ours to someplace in the world like Iraq.
Mm-hmm. And is that how we got the coalition of the billing?
Excuse me?
Is that how we got the coalition of the billing that joined us for the phony coalition in Iraq?
Well, yeah. I mean, most people think that those other countries that sent troops to Iraq in support of ours did it because they believed in the cause. In many, many cases, that's simply not true. They did it because they were blackmailed into doing it, because they owe us so much money. And we said, look, we'll forgive a little of your debt, or we won't pressure you if you will send troops in support of ours. That'll replace some of your debt.
Mm-hmm.
And we in the United States don't understand that, which I think is a terrible travesty. We're a democracy, and democracies are built on the preposition that the electorate is informed. If our electorate doesn't know about some of our most basic foreign policies, then you have to question whether we're truly an informed electorate and really can even claim to be a democracy. Forget about Chad, you know, and stolen elections. I think those are important issues, but an even bigger one is, do the American people really understand what we're doing in the world? And I'm afraid the answer for the most part is no. That's why I wrote the books, to help them understand better.
John Perkins with us on the Peter B. Collins Show. John, next, describe your notion of the word empire as it applies to the United States and the current administration's neocon vision.
Well, you know, I want to start off by saying it isn't just the current administration. We've been building this empire under Democratic as well as Republican presidents. And in Secret History, I outline, like, there's basically 8 points to what constitute an empire. And if you match any two of those, you're an empire. We meet all 8 of them, which is interesting. But there's things like, you know, our culture pervades the whole world. We have a huge military that's based in many countries throughout the world. Our language pervades throughout the world, and our monetary system pervades throughout the world.
Mm-hmm.
And some people would say, but there's no emperor. And in fact, we do have an emperor, but it's not a single individual, unlike in other times of empire. This is really a collection of people, which I call the corporatocracy. These are the men and a few women who run our biggest corporations. It's not a conspiracy. These guys all went basically to the same schools. They all operate on the premise that the most important thing for their corporations to do is make huge profits every quarter for a few rich people who basically own the biggest shares in the company. And they basically control our media for the most part, the mainstream media, either through outright ownership or through advertising. They control our government. They finance most of the political campaigns around the country,
mm-hmm.
They and their associates. And in fact, they're not elected. They don't serve a limited term. And they don't really report to anybody, which are 3 of the characteristics of an emperor.
Let me read a couple of paragraphs here from the prologue of the new book. The power base of the corporatocracy is its corporations. They define our world. When we look at a globe, we see the outlines of slightly less than 200 countries. Many of the boundaries were established by colonial powers, and most of these countries have minimal impact on their neighbors. From a geopolitical viewpoint, this model is archaic. The reality of our modern world might better be represented by huge clouds that encircle the planet, each symbolizing a multinational corporation. These powerful entities impact every single country. Their tentacles reach into the deepest rainforests and most remote deserts. The corporatocracy makes a show of promoting democracy and transparency among the nations of the world, yet its corporations are imperialistic dictatorships where a few, a very few, make all the decisions and reap most of the profits. In our electoral process, the very heart of our democracy, most of us get to vote only for candidates whose campaign chests are full. Therefore, we must select from among those who are beholden to the corporations and the men who own them. Contrary to our ideals, this empire is built on foundations of greed, secrecy, and excessive materialism. I think that really nails it. One other term I'd like you to define before we dig into some of the great stories in the book, John Perkins, is jackal. What's a jackal?
Well, on the rare instances when we economic hitmen fail to bring a country around, essentially by corrupting its leaders, then the jackals are sent in. And these are men and sometimes women who overthrow governments or assassinate their leaders. So I failed with Omar Torrijos in Panama and also with Jaime Roldos in Ecuador. I was not able to corrupt either of those men and bring them around and have them accept the deals that we wanted to put together. And so both of them were assassinated by CIA-sponsored jackals. Usually these people work for private corporations these days, not directly for the government, but they're brought in by the CIA, by our intelligence community.
Now, John Perkins, that little blast from the past I think is really interesting because it just shows how prescient you were. And you didn't know about Occupy, but you outlined some of the themes of the anti-corporate mentality that Bernie Sanders has capitalized on in his run for president. And you also described what many people refer to as the deep state, that government is there and it doesn't really matter who the president or the figureheads are who are seen as running it. So with this in mind, let me just trigger you with one word. Greece,
yeah.
What happened in Greece?
It was a great movie. sorry. You know, Greece, let me just back off a little bit by saying that, so I think that interview was 2007, I think you said off mic.
Yeah.
So in the last 9 years, things have gotten a lot worse. And that's why I wrote The New Confessions of an Economic Hitman, because the economic hitman system has spread from the developing countries where I worked to the United States and Europe, including Greece and the rest of the world.
Yeah.
So it's really gotten worse. On the other hand, people have woken up to the fact a lot more, too. I mean, there's a lot more information that's come out at Edward Snowden and WikiLeaks and so much. You know, Greece is a classic case of how this system came home to roost in Europe and basically destroyed Greece. I don't know, you know, I love the statement that the former finance minister of Greece, who wrote an endorsement for this new book, said, and I'm trying to find it here. It's in here someplace.
Go ahead. As you're doing that, I just want to comment that I found it fascinating in 2015 as the new Cyprus government tried to renegotiate the deal with the bankers of Europe and Germany in particular. And they insisted on basically destroying what was left of the economy in Greece in exchange for getting the bankers paid. And the bailout money that came, you know, was laundered through the Greek central bank, but it wasn't spent there. The money came from Europe, went to Greece, and then was sent right back to Europe to pay off the bankers.
Yeah.
And when you look at that astounding process as people are, you know, burning the furniture to keep their living room warm, the world operated with remarkable cynicism. And it was a true banker's first mentality.
Well, you know, every serious economist knows that austerity is not the way to pull a country out of economic crisis. You know, Joe Stiglitz, former chief economist of the World Bank, Nobel Prize winner, Krugman, another Nobel Prize winner in economics, they all point out that, you know, the way to pull a country out is by spending money on the people, not pulling the bankers out. So Yanis Varoufakis, who is the former Minister of Finance of Greece, and on the opening page of the book, praises for the new economic New Confessions of an Economic Hitman, says, "When I read Confessions of an Economic Hitman, I could not have known that some years later I would be on the receiving end of the type of economic hit that Perkins so vividly narrated. This new book resonates with my experiences," and I love this phrase, "my experiences of the brutish methods and gross economic irrationality guiding powerful institutions in their bid to undermine democratic control over economic power."
Mm-hmm.
Perkins has once again made a substantial contribution to a world that needs whistleblowers to open the eyes, its eyes to the true sources of political, social, and economic power. I want to repeat that phrase, Peter, if it's okay
mm-hmm.
with you, because
sure.
this man's a brilliant man, Yiannis, you know, and he's mm-hmm. now traveling around Europe. He left the Greek government because they folded, they gave in, and he's traveling around Europe trying to organize movements for more democracy.
Mm-hmm.
He's again, the sentence is, this book resonates with my experiences, his experiences, of the brutish methods and gross economic irrationality guiding powerful institutions in their bid to undermine democratic control over economic power.
Mm-hmm.
That sums it up so beautifully. You know, the brutish methods and gross economic irrationality
yeah.
that's brought to bear by powerful institutions to undermine democratic control over economic power.
And in Greece, the economic hitmen worked for Goldman Sachs. They came in and they said, "Hey, you got a problem here. Your budget is sideways because of your pension obligations. And we're going to use some special Enron voodoo and make that disappear. We're going to take your liabilities and place them offshore." And that was what led to the collapse of the Greek economy. And then, John, to add insult to that injury, last year, after they hammered the austerity program into effect and forced the Tsipras government onto its knees, then the refugee crisis became, you know, centrally focused on Greece as the first transit point for people coming from Turkey. So what did the European Union do? They turned around and gave, or pledged, I don't think they've actually delivered it, $3 billion to help with refugee problems. They gave it to Turkey. Not to Greece, the company that has been a country that has been most impacted and that desperately needs the money.
Right.
It's just incredible.
Yeah, well, bring Greece down, you know, and unfortunately, the Greece bent and gave in. That's one mm-hmm. of the reasons that the Europeans keep going after them. Unlike Iceland, which refused to pay its loans and has pulled itself out, and, mm-hmm. and nobody's touching Iceland.
Yeah. Now let's bring this closer to home. Because the same pattern is occurring on an island possession of the United States called Puerto Rico. $72 billion in debt, the same process with one little overlay. Most of the bonds that were sold by the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico are now held by a handful of vulture capitalists who, as Bernie Sanders pointed out in a recent debate, bought that debt for 30 cents on the dollar. And they are busy imposing austerity on Puerto Rico, where most of the young members of the labor force have left, and the infrastructure is collapsing, and the federal laws don't permit Puerto Rico to file for bankruptcy, like Detroit was able to do.
Right. And yes, and the same thing is true internationally. There are no laws that allow countries to file for bankruptcy. And, you know, Argentina is another case, a country that just settled with the vulture capitalists.
Mm-hmm.
I talk in the New Confessions of an Economic Hitman about how these vulture funds and the capitalists, the people behind them, are, like Paul Singer, are the new form of economic hitman, one of the new forms. Wall Street, mm-hmm. the Wall Street moguls, the bankers, a lot of politicians who take a tremendous amount of money to finance their campaigns from big corporations, and also know that if they lose the election or decide not to run again, mm-hmm. they'll get extremely lucrative jobs as consultants, lobbyists for big corporations.
Right.
These are all new forms of economic hitmen that didn't even exist in my time in that way.
Mm-hmm.
That's huge corruption. And the fact that these venture funds can hold these countries up for ransom is just outrageous. It's just just totally outrageous. It's just gluttonous, outrageous, and it's bringing the world down. We are actually creating an economy that's consuming itself into extinction. You know, it's just not working.
And John, I mentioned Detroit, but Flint is actually a slightly better example, and it's fresh in people's minds right now because of the lead poisoning caused by the change in the water supply that was imposed by the emergency manager. But what most people don't know, or maybe, you know, the media doesn't bother to tell us, is that the emergency manager law that enabled this whole debacle was passed by the legislature and signed by the governor in 2012. And in November of 2012, the voters of Michigan repealed it. In December of 2012, the same legislature and the same governor rammed through a new emergency manager law over the objections of the voters. And just to add a little gratuitous slap, in the same breath almost, they passed a right-to-work law in Michigan, the cradle of organized labor. And it is that arrogance and this desire to eviscerate political opponents that has led to this power grab. And now, you know, kids and other people in Flint are going to pay a price, perhaps, for their entire lives.
Yeah, well, that's the system, and that's why I say it's come home to roost. It's a cancer. The economic hitman system is a cancer that's metastasized, and it's spread throughout the world. It's come back here to roost. You know, in a way, the use of this system was sort of saturated in the developing countries, and so there's looking for new frontiers, you know. The economic hitman said, well, we've done what we could in Africa and Asia and Latin America, and now what's the next? Well, let's go to the United States and Europe. And it's been very effective, and Flint is a good example of that. It's a good example of how even though we elect officials, they do not serve the people who elected them. They serve the people who finance them and who they know are going to give them jobs if they lose elections or decide not to run. You know, I think during some of my lifetime, at least, Peter, our elected officials did what the people who elected them wanted them to do, or at least what they thought was best for those people. That's no longer true at all. We elect them, and they serve the big corporations. You know, I was surprised in the interview you played earlier where I talked about the United States being a democracy. It's not. In 2007, I could still believe that we had hopes of following in that trajectory, but I don't anymore. We're an oligarchy. We're not a democracy by any stretch of the imagination. But the marketplace is a democracy, and we need to understand that and work through that to change the corporations. That's the leverage point now, to change the corporations. They are run by the single goal. It's the driving force behind corporations of maximizing profits regardless of the social and environmental costs. And that's a goal that was only established in 1976. And it can be changed. We can change that.
John, one woman who I connect to some of the same kind of exposure that you have offered us about this whole sequence and the players is Naomi Klein. And her book about disaster capitalism, to me, is still a very important work. Have you ever been on a show with her, or do you know her? Have you exchanged ideas? Because you have similar perspectives, I would say.
Yeah, and I met Naomi. The last time I saw her, she and a number of other people, Matt Damon and Amy Goodman and I were attending Howard Zinn's memorial service in Boston, and we spent a little time talking, but I've never spent any in-depth time with her. I'd love to do that, but she's traveling all the time. I'm traveling all the time. And, you know, to a certain degree, that's the way to do it, divide and conquer. You know, if we hang out too much together, we won't get the word out there so much. But she does great work. I have tremendous respect for her. She's a brilliant, brilliant mind and a terribly courageous person.
Well, I think that her work really provides a detailed underpinning for some of the activities that you have exposed of economic hitmen. and the theories behind it, the Chicago School of Economics, the way the World Bank and the IMF are used to force countries who are already, you know, economically vulnerable to open their markets to American corporations, to get rid of labor unions and anything else that would, provide problems for a company that wants to exploit the labor market in that particular country. And Haiti, you know, following the earthquake and the joint efforts of the United States government with Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State and the Clinton Foundation, where Bill Clinton was bringing the money that he raised from corporate interests and from nefarious governments around the world into Haiti to, as some people have described it, really completely rebuild that economy into a corporate sweatshop.
Right.
And that fits the same MO that both you and Naomi Klein describe.
Yes. It's a shocking situation that so many Americans don't get that. You know, Haiti is a prime example of how we use this system. And I'll tell you another one that goes along with Haiti, and that's Honduras, mm-hmm. where in 2009 we overthrew the democratically, by we I mean the CIA, the United States, overthrew the democratically elected president of Honduras, mm-hmm. Manuel Zelaya.
Zelaya?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because he was planning, in fact, he instituted an increase in minimum wages of 60%. Which was very fair because minimum wages were extremely low, and also some land reform policies, all of which were very upsetting to Dole and Chiquita and several of our athletic supply companies, not just because of the impact it would have on those companies there, but also because Haiti and Honduras set the bottom bar as far as minimum wage for the whole hemisphere is concerned. Nobody in the hemisphere, no other country will go below that bar. So if either Haiti or Honduras raises their minimum wage, everybody else is going to have to do it too. So they had to be, Haiti had to be kept down, and when the president refused to listen to the economic hitmen who went down there to convince him not to implement these policies, he was taken out in a coup. He wasn't assassinated, right. Fortunately, but he was taken out in a coup.
But the U.S. kept him on ice and kept him from returning until they could engineer a quickie election to install the current leader.
Well, the leader before this one, his name was Lobo, which means wolf, and he was one of the most draconian, brutal dictators we've seen in the hemisphere, and today Honduras has the highest homicide rate of any country in the hemisphere, one of the highest in the world, if not the highest. And of course, as it's come out recently, the Obama administration was implicated. The Secretary of State Hillary Clinton was very much implicated in that whole process. And I think that's something we Americans have to understand. And I'm, you know, I don't want to single out the Clintons or anybody else for that matter. It's systemic. We need to understand that. Just recently, I just was reading this morning some of the emails that have now become apparent, that have become, mm-hmm. become public information that around Hillary Clinton's time as Secretary of State and the terrible things we did in Libya and the lies that were told to us about the reasons why we took out Gaddafi. You know,
right.
it was about money. It was about the U.S. dollar. It was about supporting the U.S. dollar more than anything else.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting. Last week in his interview with, I think it's Jeffrey Goldberg at The Atlantic, President Obama admitted that dumping Gaddafi was a mistake.
Well, Gaddafi, he could be brutal, certainly, but under him, there's huge infrastructure projects that brought water to amazing numbers of people. He increased agricultural production phenomenally. He increased education and health care. He did a lot of great things for that country.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, he could be brutal also, but you can say that about most leaders for that matter. And it's, you know, the American people were kept in the dark about that, still are, although it's in these emails exchanged with the Secretary of State Clinton and others, so much of that comes out, including how we destroyed this dam, this huge irrigation system, this amazingly effective irrigation system. We systematically went in, our forces went in and destroyed a very productive irrigation and water system in that country in the name of what, trying to overthrow a dictator,
mm-hmm.
but destroying this very, very impressive infrastructure. Now, of course, that gives us the opportunity, if we can get a new government in there that will let us, to rebuild,
mm-hmm.
to send our corporations in to rebuild all of that infrastructure.
Bechtel's already got bids prepared.
I'm sure they do. I'm sure they do.
John Perkins is my guest. We're talking about his latest book, The New Confessions of an Economic Hitman. And he added 15 fresh chapters to the story that he has been telling since the original book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, that spent 73 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list. And I want to thank your publisher, John, because they have donated that stack of books to your right, and you've agreed to autograph them for my listeners. And we're going to be giving these away to people who take out a new subscription to the Peter B. Collins podcast. So I want to thank you and your publisher for that. And I also recommend this book to people. You don't have to take out a subscription to my podcast. You can go buy the book, because I think there's a lot of important information and perspective here. And one of the things that really got my attention in the additional chapters, John, is where you answer the question, who are today's jackals? And I was really surprised when you answered your question with America's drone program.
Yeah, that's part of it. And Peter, I'd like to say, that, incidentally, that, yeah, I'm grateful to my publishers. It's a great publishing company, Barrett Kohler in San Francisco. And incidentally, they are a certified benefit corporation, and they do everything to use good paper and good ink as much as they possibly can. So, yeah, I thank them, too.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got a whole new assortment of jackals out there. Drone operators are part of that system. This incredible police surveillance that we have all over, the cameras, the low-flying aircraft that the FBI have. I provide the numbers in the book. I don't remember them, but they're horrifying, the numbers of low-flying aircraft that the FBI has over our major cities.
You know about dirt boxes.
Yeah, also.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know,
and just let me explain. DIRT, it stands for the company that makes it, DRT. And it is a box that you can put in a Cessna, and it flies over the area, and it captures the cell signals of every phone within its range. And it in essence, is a dragnet surveillance program that violates the rights of thousands of innocent people as they tell us they're looking for, you know, specific suspects in given cases. And also, the president's comments Friday in Austin, where he was defending the attack on Apple to try to force them to hack into the San Bernardino iPhone, he made it clear that terrorism is not the only focus of these enhanced enforcement techniques. And he started talking about child porn purveyors and people like that. And this is a big problem with mission creep, where, you know, we're told that these extreme measures are necessary to take on the evils of terrorism. And then, in short order, you know, they're using it for any run-of-the-mill law enforcement effort.
Terrorism is such a smoke and mirrors game here. You know, I just want to say that there's no such thing as global terrorism. There are global acts of terror, but an ism is something that people believe in a common set of principles, capitalism, Catholicism, socialism. I've interviewed members of FARC in Colombia. I've interviewed members of the Somali pirate organization people and Al-Qaeda. They don't have any common set of principles. All they have that's in common is desperation. And when people are desperate, they turn anywhere they can for help. When they feel that they're not getting the help from their governments, or in fact it's the opposite, are getting beat up by their governments, they'll turn to fanatics. And sometimes those fanatics may be very wealthy people like Osama bin Laden. But the majority of the people are desperate. They're poor. They're on the verge of starvation. Their families are starving. And they turn to desperation. So if we want to get rid of global acts of terror, then we need to get rid of the causes of terror. We need to get rid of the free trade agreements, quote-unquote, like CAFTA and NAFTA, which are causing so much suffering in Central America. And TTIP and TPP will do the same things. We need to get rid of these causes. And people need to understand this. This idea of global terrorism is an excuse for extreme measures of the police state.
Well, I certainly underscore what you're saying. And let me just pick one quick example. I published in mid-December a list of 13 questions that remain mostly unanswered about the San Bernardino shooting of December 2nd, 2015. And, for example, the initial eyewitness accounts, multiple ones, said that the shooters were three in number. They were all male. They were all tall. Some of them were described exclusively as white. Within a day, we were told that there were only two shooters, and neither were white, neither was tall. She was 5'3 and barely over 100 pounds. Then we're told that she, Malik, posted on Facebook a pledge of allegiance to al-Baghdadi, the leader of the Islamic State. Only nobody has ever produced that Facebook post. We're not allowed to see it. The FBI director leaked it to the New York Times, and the New York Times ran with it, and they have, you know, dialed back a little bit. Chloe doesn't like this kind of stuff. You can understand. She gets worked up when I talk about it. But you know, this is a very weak case, as it has been presented in the corporate media, and there are no skeptics. It was only a week ago when one of the survivors who's advocating for Apple to open the iPhone raised the question about where's the third suspect? Where's the third shooter? The media took 90 days and blacked out the third shooter question, and then suddenly it's back. Now, you know, I believe that an event occurred. I believe that people were killed. You know, and I'm not, you know, claiming that this is all fiction. But the narratives are so sloppily written and the continuity is so weak that no self-respecting screenwriter in Hollywood would even accept the narratives that we are fed these days, John.
So why do we accept these things? You know, you got to really ask yourself.
Well, because it was on TV.
Yeah.
And some guy with really good hair said it was true.
Right. Yeah. You know, it is sad because we know that we've been lied to over and over and over again. Yeah, I'm not what you call a conspiracy theorist or whatever the hell that means, but that there's some great grand conspiracy. There's a Dr. No up there that's pulling the strings. However, as I talk in the book, I point out there's a lot of conspiracies that we know happened. There was, you know, the conspiracy of weapons of mass destruction. They weren't there. We know there was a conspiracy. The Bay of Pigs was a conspiracy. We know there have been so many conspiracies. And, of course, our own government is always talking about the conspiracies, the mm-hmm. conspiracies of the Islamic extremists to do this and to do that. But why people continue to believe these stories? And I don't know what's true in the case that you're talking about. I don't know what's true in the 9/11 case, but we do know that there's a lot of holes in that whole theory there.
I think that most people will honestly admit that we don't know the truth about 9/11, but it is such a mindfuck to go into it, the can of worms, and say, well, if the truth, you know, the story we've been told isn't true, then what is true? And that leads a lot of people just to repel. They can't face it.
We don't want to believe that our government could have possibly been involved in anything mm-hmm. like that. And, you know, it just is another case in point as to why we are not a democracy.
Yeah.
And we're an oligarchy. And I say that with tears in my eyes, truly, because I want to believe in this country. My ancestors fought in the American Revolution. We're at another time when we need a revolution here. You know, they stood up against the strongest empire in the history of the world at the time. And it's time for us to stand up against the strongest economic interests that the world has ever known, who are massed against us. You know, 62 individuals have as much money as half the world's population. Mm-hmm. 7 out of 10 people live in countries with greater inequality today than 30 years ago. Things have gotten a lot worse, which is why I wrote Confessions of an Economic Human. And in the last part of that book, it outlined a strategy for what we have to do to change this, including lists of things that everybody can do and that students can do, another list that retired people can do, and on and on. Mm-hmm. The important thing is for us to do something, for us the people to understand that no matter who the next president is, he or she is not going to have that much power, but we do. And I'd like to tell people, you know, whatever candidate appeals to you, take a look at what policy of theirs most appeals to you. Mm-hmm. And then regardless of who makes it to the Oval Office, push for that. If that candidate makes it, make that candidate follow through on that policy. Push, push, push. If that candidate doesn't make it, go out there on social media and make it happen. Because mm-hmm. we have the power to make that happen. And that is truly what democracy is about. We need to take back the power.
And you have these lists of things that people can do. And I just picked this one because there are only five elements. It's five things entrepreneurs can do. Follow your heart, get started, build communities, be the company you envision for the future, and undertake the 11 actions outlined in another part of the book.
Yeah. And actually, you know something, Peter? You've got the advanced uncorrected galley that you're looking at there, but the books you're going to give to these people are the actual book.
Right.
So that list is now longer.
Oh.
There's more than five on that list now. Yeah.
John, one thing also that struck me is your commitment to the Pachamama Alliance. And I only know a little bit about it. A friend said, hey, let's go to lunch. And she took me to a Pachamama fundraiser.
Oh, my.
And I was so blown away. There are more than 1,000 people in this huge building over at Fort Mason. And Lynn Twist gets up there. And she is so impressive because she is a very skilled fundraiser. Mm-hmm. But her commitment to the mission of Pachamama is something that just comes through. It oozes out of her pores. So talk a little bit about Pachamama and why you're involved with it.
Well, it's an amazing organization, and if any of your listeners don't know about it, please go to Pachamama.org. Also go to johnperkins.org. That will link you there. Sign up for my newsletter while you're at it, and there's more on there. But so, you know, I was a Peace Corps volunteer in the Ecuadorian Amazon with the Shuar people, deep in the Amazon, indigenous people, back in the late 60s until through 1970. And then in about the end of the 1980s, I went back and told these people, after I'd been an economic hitman, I wanted to help them. I wanted to redeem myself for what I'd done as an economic hitman. And one of the things they said, you know, is if you want to help us save our forests, that's great. But don't come here and try to change us. We're not the problem. The problem is your oil companies, your lumber companies, your dream. Basically, you know, your perceived reality of the world, your dream of the world, your paradigm. You've had this dream of lots of industry, heavy industry, big buildings, lots of cars. That dream may have done some good for a while, but now you understand it's a nightmare. You've got to change it. So change the dream of your people. The whole story is in the New Confessions of an Economic Hitman about how then I contacted Lynn Twist, who is an absolutely amazing human being, mm-hmm. a saint, a true living saint. And, you know, I'm here in your offices now in Marin County, but I'm staying at the Twist House. So every time I go to San Francisco, I'm spending almost a week and a half with Bill and Lynn Twist.
Mm-hmm.
So Lynn put together a group of people to go down and visit these people in the Amazon with me and her husband, Bill.
Mm-hmm.
Out of that came what's now the Pachamama Alliance. Bill has become its executive director. We have an incredible board of directors. And our mission is nothing less than to create an environmentally sustainable, spiritually fulfilling, socially just human presence on this planet. The mandate came from these people in the jungle, but they said it came from the rainforest itself. That it's not about just about saving them and their rainforest. It's about saving the world as we know it.
Mm-hmm.
Because let's face it, we're in crisis. We're in the process of consuming ourselves into extinction, essentially, or at least changing the world so that our grandchildren won't recognize what we see of it today. We must turn that around, and that's what the Pachamama Alliance is all about. We work in the Amazon. We spend a lot of time there, but we also are in, I think, 83 or 84 countries now with our Awakening the Dreamer program, which is about a four-hour program that really inspires people to change the dream, mm-hmm. to awaken to that. And yeah, that luncheon you mentioned, which this year, this coming year, is going to be November 3rd. It's actually going to be a dinner this year,
mm-hmm.
At Fort Mason in San Francisco. I'll be there. I go to them, Lynn and Bill, and I give an opening speech. And
yeah.
then Bill and Lynn really take over. They run the place. I was just kind of the visionary. I'm still on the board of directors. I'm considered one of the three co-founders,
mm-hmm.
but I'm the one that kind of goes out in the world and talks a lot about it, and they run the organization on a day-to-day basis.
I've been to a lot of fundraisers, and I've hosted and, you know, helped organize fundraisers. This was the most well-oiled thing I've ever seen. And just as dessert was being served, Lynn said, you know, we could use a plane. We need a plane. Anybody got a plane? And there were three people who raised their hands and were ready to donate, you know, a single-engined, like a Cessna or, you know, a Piper plane like that.
And there wasn't the FBI with their...
no dirt boxes. Planes.
No dirt boxes. And we got the plane. It wasn't we who needed the plane. It was the Achua people who we work with, and they needed a plane because they live deep in the jungle, and when they have emergencies, they need to be able to get people in and out. Also, to protect their lands against the oil companies,
mm-hmm.
they need to be able to communicate better, and a plane is the best way to do that. It takes a long time to hike through the forest. You know, it can take you 10 days to get to the next village, but if mm-hmm. you got a plane, you can do it in 15 minutes, you know.
Yeah.
So we got the plane.
Mm-hmm. John Perkins joining us now is our mutual friend Randy Hayes. Randy and I bonded when we were called to jury duty, but rejected for service. And we've been talking on and off for years. He, of course, was the founder of the Rainforest Action Network, brought Burger King to the table. Many other great achievements as an advocate and an activist. He's been working on green energy issues and what's that tariff thing called, Randy, the feed-in tariff?
Yeah, the German renewable energy policy is called a feed-in tariff.
Right, I remember that. And update our listeners, what is your current focus? What projects are you currently working on, Randy?
I have a secret strategy to ecologize capitalism.
All right.
I set up a think tank called Foundation Earth around ecological economics and how to restructure the rules of the capital market global economic system.
Now, how's it going? are we there yet?
We are absolutely not there, but there's a zeitgeist building. It's a race against time.
Uh-huh.
You know, can we internalize those pesky pollution externalities, and can we ratchet economic activity down around carrying capacity limits? Those are the two main questions I address.
I'll have to say, Peter, so Randy and I had lunch together and spent a couple hours together in Washington, D.C., maybe about a week ago. And I think we took another step forward in that direction. We decided to create the alternative to Davos sort of thing,
mm-hmm.
a group of people that can really make this happen. And I know Randy's totally committed to it, and so am I. And let's get you involved in it, too.
Okay, I'll collude. No problem. I'd be happy to conspire with you. Now, Randy, the reason I asked you to join us here today is I was listening to an interview that I did with Mr. Perkins here way back, I think it was about 2007. And in his book at that time, he had described a night where he jumped into a hot tub with you and an executive from Mitsubishi, where you had been negotiating with the Mitsubishi guy across the table. And I wanted you to tell that story, and I think I tried to get you in on that interview, but it didn't work out. And so, I always struggle to serve my listeners as effectively as I can. And I'd like to get that anecdote on the record here. So could you set the scene for us? Where were you, and what was the context before you and Perkins had this hot tub encounter?
Well, the larger context is, of course, you have these giant transnational corporations that wield a lot of economic power and political power, and of all the brands that the listeners will have heard of from Japan, they belong to about seven super brands,
mm-hmm.
Keiretsus, they're called, conglomerates.
Right.
The biggest of those is Mitsubishi, the Mitsubishi Keiretsu. So if in the domino theory of social change, if you can knock off the biggest domino, perhaps the smaller ones will fall in lockstep with that. And so going after Mitsubishi was a big target. They were a major wood products trader in Southeast Asia. They were responsible for destruction of a lot of the ancient rainforests of Borneo, the last hunting and gathering tribe over there. So within any large corporation, there are, of course, people that are sympathetic. Many of them were members of the Rainforest Action Network, people who worked for Burger King, for Home Depot, and indeed for Mitsubishi. So that was the larger context. And we had finally come to a settlement agreement with Mitsubishi. And lo and behold, John Perkins and I end up at this conference in Santa Barbara up in the hills, looking out over the Pacific Ocean, you know, as the moon's about to set. And he shows up, as I recalled, with a six-pack of cold beer. And indeed, you know, we were pretty happy to crawl into a hot tub there. And lo and behold, comes along other conference goers, one including a man named Kim Custer, who was a senior executive for Mitsubishi Motor Sales America. We had been beating them to a pulp for the last several years around Mitsubishi's activities destroying rainforests. Well, somebody like Kim Custer didn't want to see the rainforest destroyed. That's not why he took a job at Mitsubishi Motor Sales. You know, he was trying to get a paycheck and feed his family. He was empathetic, and he frankly was appreciative of us raising this important issue and pressuring the corporation until they got down on one bended knee and had to negotiate a settlement. And John Perkins kind of cajoled this story out of Kim Custer while we were in the hot tub.
Well, I think it's fair to say that at one point, after a couple of these beers we'd all had, Kim raises his can of beer and says, "I just want to toast you, Randy Hayes, because you forced our organization to do the right thing." And he said, you know, I, Kim Custer, and many other executives wanted our organization to do this, but we couldn't force it to do it. We would have lost our jobs.
Mm-hmm.
But when Rainforest Action Network and Randy Hayes came after us and made this go very, very public, the organization then had to do the right thing. At one point, after having several beers, Kim Custer raises his can of beer over the hot tub and says, I just want to salute you, Randy Hayes. Because you and Rainforest Action Network forced our organization to do the right thing. And he said, I, Kim Custer, and many of our other executives and people at Mitsubishi always wanted to do the right thing. We wanted to protect the rainforest, but we didn't dare speak out. We were afraid we'd lose our jobs. So when Rainforest Action Network came after us and made this very public, and our executives had to make the decision to change the policies, we're very grateful. And I think, Peter, that what this points out is the power that we the people have. As I was saying earlier, it's we who have to change things, that the leaders aren't going to do it. And I run into so many corporate heads, and I'm sure Randy does too, who will say, you know, I want to be greener. I've got kids. I've got grandchildren. I want to create a better world, but I'm afraid if I lose half a percentage of market share, the main stockholders will fire me, and the next guy will only care about market share. So what I want you to do is go out there, organize lots of our consumers to send emails and all kinds of social networking information, overwhelm us with messages that, gosh, we love your product, but we're not going to buy it anymore until you stop cutting rainforest trees, or you clean up the oil spills you've created, or you pay your workers in Indonesia a fair wage or something like that. And Rainforest Action Network and the leadership that Randy's shown there is a tremendous example of the power that a fairly small number of people can have to bring these big corporations around.
And Randy, John is making the case that our consumer power is actually greater than whatever power is vested in us as voters. Do you share that view, particularly in the oligarchic trend that we're seeing in America today, particularly related to elections?
At this era of politics in the United States, our voting power doesn't feel as powerful as perhaps it is. but we can't throw the baby out with the bathwater. We can vote with our dollars every day in terms of what we buy or choose not to buy, but we really do need to get elected officials in there that understand the urgency of the situation, because we can't afford to have slow solutions to fast problems. And the house is on fire in terms of the planet's ability to support life. Industrial civilization for the last 200 years is just ravaging this planet. And so we need to use every tool in the toolbox, and that includes our consumer power, voting with our dollars. But we've got these elections coming up, and it matters. It matters who's in there.
Well, Randy, the point that I was making is that I don't know how much it matters, because I think whoever gets in the White House is suddenly going to be read the Riot Act, and going to be, even if it's Sanders and he doesn't take any money from big corporations, he's going to be surrounded by politicians and lobbyists who have taken lots of money from corporations and whose future depends on, if they don't get elected, they'll become consultants or lobbyists for the corporations, or if they choose not to run. And so...
And John, to that point, Scott Shain, the New York Times writer, published a book. It's called Objective Troy. It's about the drones that you describe as jackals. Mm. It was about the targeted killing of Anwar al-Awlaki. And he... you know, it points to a specific day, 2 days after Obama was elected, at a SCIF, a secured room in Chicago, where Michael Hayden, former CIA director, former NSA director, gave him his first real full briefing. And that appears to be the point at which Obama entered the dark side. And his options were then sharply limited by the realities that were visited upon him. We don't know what those realities were. We can imagine a lot of it had to do with, you know, intelligence and black ops and things like that. But at least that's one pivotal point that Shain points to, and it makes it a little easier, I think, for people to imagine what happens to a guy who was elected, and I thought, well, you know, he's going to make an attempt to return us to constitutional rule and stop the violations of our Bill of Rights under domestic surveillance and law enforcement. And instead, he's actually extended the bad policies and precedents of the Bush administration. Randy, you want to make a comment?
Well, yeah, I think John and yourself are making valid points that to some extent we have a twiddledum dilemma. We're told that we have a two-party system, but it's not just a cynical response that would say we have the Democratic side of the big business party and we have the Republican side of the big business party, and they're not without distinction, certainly on social and cultural issues. There's great distinctions. On economic issues, there's less distinctions, and probably on that kind of a military prowess to back up the economic powers that be, that John speaks to and writes so eloquently about. This is all really quite true. So I'm not... overly excited about democracy. I am excited about ecologically informed public governance.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a phrase that says a lot more than seeking democracy, because right now that means kind of two sides of the same coin, in that an Obama, as just you said, gets in there and doesn't feel the political power to shift the Titanic. And indeed, he doesn't have the political power to shift the Titanic.
Mm-hmm.
But again, you know, ecologically informed public governance, we've got to put the public back in the government, but we've got to have an ecologically informed public out there.
And that is a challenge. Well, I can see that the two of you would be great guests for a future program. So I'm going to put that on my list, and I'd love to get the two of you together for a fuller conversation and not just the hot tub anecdote and a couple of comments. So, Randy, thank you for being available to talk with us today. I do appreciate it. And John Perkins, thank you for coming to the Secret Studio. It's great to finally meet you in person. And I highly recommend your new book, The New Confessions of an Economic Hitman. It's out in softcover from Barrett Kohler Books right now.
I'd also like to suggest that people go to my website, johnperkins.org, sign up for the newsletter. And what about you, Randy? How can people get in touch with you?
Well, Foundation Earth, you can just Google Foundation Earth and you'll find our think tank. And there's an essay, Towards a True Cost Economy, that's a good starting point. But I'm about halfway through the new book, and it's a powerful rendition of so much of American history that's not well taught. And John's a great writer. It's a real treat to be reading this updated book.
Indeed.
Thanks, Randy. Let's get together in a hot tub, the three of us, sometime and do a program from there. How's that?
Not bad. That sounds good. I'll bring, I don't do beer, but I'll bring wine, okay?
All right.
All right, guys, I'm going to sign off and let you guys take over. But it was great being on this. Thanks for including me.
You bet. Bye-bye. Randy Hayes, John Perkins, thanks to both of you today, and happy trails to you. I'm Peter B. Collins. Thanks for listening. I always appreciate your comments and feedback. You can email Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.